is Love Your Work. On this show, we help you find success on your own terms. I'm David Cadavy. I've been an independent creator for more than 10 years. I've written a couple best-selling books, Designed for Hackers and Now the Heart to Start. If you are new here, welcome. Again, I'm David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast's app. John Ramey found success as an entrepreneur. He dropped out of college with only one semester left, moved to Silicon Valley, and built a successful startup. After he sold his startup, John traveled the world helping budding ecosystems promote entrepreneurship. He ended up setting up a program called Nomadic Mentors, which pairs experienced entrepreneurs with incubator and accelerator programs around the world in developing markets. By the way, I'm one of those mentors in Nomadic Mentors. I've done a trip to Greece and to Serbia where I spoke and helped entrepreneurs. And after John traveled the world, he served as the innovation advisor to the Obama White House. He set up a program at the Pentagon for making government innovation happen in months rather than decades. And now that John has had that success, has traveled the world, and has seen firsthand how governments work, including very intimately with the U.S. government and a trip to North Korea that you're going to hear about, what is it that John is now dedicating his time to? He's actually running a site for prepping. Now, you may have seen some reality shows with shifty-eyed people prepping for nuclear fallout or a zombie apocalypse. This is not that. John affectionately refers to himself as a sane prepper. If you go to his site, which is at theprepared.com, you can see that John is quite sane. He provides incredibly detailed and practical information on all sorts of disaster or emergency preparedness supplies. On theprepared.com, you'll find prepping checklists for emergencies such as earthquakes, hurricanes, and car accidents. You'll find detailed reviews of supplies such as water storage containers and non-perishable food. You'll also find everything that you need to be informed on how to best prepare you, your family, and your home for an emergency. This is a very long conversation. John has really seen the matrix, so to speak, that rules our daily lives. And I think this is a good view into that. So hear about how he lived in Silicon Valley on $2.85 a day. And how did he end up working at the White House? And what was his trip to North Korea like? Why wasn't he, as an American, allowed to use the bathroom on one occasion? After all John has done, why is it that he has decided that a prepper site was the next project for him? This is one last ad-free episode. It looks like we may have a new sponsor coming up. Don't want to speak too soon, but that would be very welcome. I work with great sponsors, and I turn down sponsorship opportunities that aren't a fit. But of course, it would be great if I didn't need sponsors at all. If you want Love Your Work to continue, if you want me to keep investigating the world and providing thoughtful conversations and articles about how to fill as much of your day as possible with doing things that are nourishing and intellectually stimulating, please donate. If just about 20 more of you would buy me just a coffee a month, Love Your Work's production costs would be completely listener supported, and that would be amazing. If you'd like to be a part of making this show happen, if you want to feel good about bringing this show to thousands of people, support on Patreon at cadavy.net/donate. That is cadavy.net/donate. Thank you so much. And don't forget, I have a webinar coming up. I've spent more than 10 years as a solopreneur, and I found that when you work for yourself, it's very different from working for other people. You have to find ways to get motivated and get work done. So I'll be sharing my best self-motivation tips from over a decade as a solopreneur in my brand new webinar, Self-Motivation for Solopreneurs. It will be on Wednesday, March 7th, 2018 at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Learn more and sign up at cadavy.net/motivation. That's cadavy.net/motivation. Here's John Ramey.
Here in Medellin with my friend John Ramey. John, what are you doing in Medellin?
Came here to see you, buddy.
Yeah,
and,
did you?
And, yeah, and to look at houses.
Oh, okay. Primarily probably to look at houses.
Primarily to look
at houses. So you're thinking about buying a place down here. Why is that?
Colombia is, well, it's a great country. A lot of expats and digital nomads are spending time down here. And it has a program where if you invest in real estate, you can get permanent residency and eventually citizenship.
So you want a Colombian passport?
I'm considering basically. It, yeah. I definitely want a second passport, and I'm looking at a couple countries, including Colombia, for where to get it.
Yeah. So why are you so eager to get a second passport?
There's an optimistic side of the answer and a pessimistic side of the answer. The optimistic side is that there's more freedom, right? It's kind of digital nomad, global citizen, live where you want to live, go where you want to go kind of mentality. But the flip side of that is that there's some concerns about having all your eggs in the American basket. I have some personal pessimism about what the future is going to look like over the next few decades in America. And it's just smart, just like it's smart to diversify in any portfolio, that also includes geographic diversification.
Yeah, definitely being an expat here, it's one of these annoying things that kind of will take over your life for me once a year. It's like, okay, now you have to do a bunch of paperwork and stuff to figure out how you can stay where you are.
Right.
So I'm thinking of doing a real estate investment myself to be able to stay more permanently. But I've already been living here for a couple of years. Now, are you kind of like looking around at a bunch of different places for this thing? You're talking about getting a second passport. Does it matter to you where you get a second passport?
Oh, it certainly does, right? Like there's a bunch of second passport programs around the world that are easier to get, but they're not places that you would want to have a passport from. And they're typically third world countries are very tiny.
So what are the places where you would like to get a passport or that you think are good candidates? And it sounds like Colombia is in the running.
Yeah, Colombia is towards the top, right? So for example, I wouldn't want to get one from Brazil, right? There's too many problems with corruption and stability of the economy and things like that. Europe is obviously very heavily favored with the Schengen area because Portugal is one of these programs. And if you have a Portuguese passport, you then can live and work anywhere in the European Union. So that certainly is better than a passport from St. Kitts and Nevis, where people look at you and they know that you don't live there and it doesn't really matter all that much. So some people, if they have a tax motivation, they really want to get, a passport from Monaco or places like that for tax reasons. I think more about what would be a good basket to have my diversified portfolio in. Where is it going to be stable? What's going to be a good passport in terms of the amount of access around the world you can get, right? Like there's no point getting a Russian passport because you can't go very many places without a visa in the world. So there's a bunch of different qualities. It all boils down to where do I feel financially safe to kind of park money and hopefully let it grow, but it at least be safe and end up with a stable government, a good ecosystem, a good culture, a place I would want to live, a place I would want to visit. And then a powerful passport.
So when you're talking about diversifying the baskets that your eggs are in, what kind of things do you have in mind that you're trying to prepare for?
Well, in the work that I've done over the last 10 years, just my career where I spend my time, I've developed a pretty pessimistic view about things like the real estate market in the U.S., even just the fundamental structure of the American economy. I think we're already starting to see signs of these issues or symptoms of these issues. And I think over the next few decades, they're going to get even worse. So, nobody has a crystal ball, but in as educated a view as possible, I think the next few decades in the U.S. are frankly going to be harder than the last few decades.
So what sort of symptoms are you talking about that you're seeing right now?
Trump being elected.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sure. That's a symptom of this. Absolutely, right? It's the forgotten America and these towns that are dying, right? And people that feel left behind and ignored. Their feelings are real, but the way that people go about trying to solve those problems by electing someone like Trump is, it's the wrong solution for the problem. But it's a symptom of these issues, these kind of structural square peg round hole, or like cracks in the pillars of the building, you're starting to see them develop and grow. And sooner or later, it's going to be a bigger problem.
And so what kind of events are you trying to protect against? So you're talking about having a safe place to put your money and stuff. What does that all look like?
What do you mean?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what you mean. are there scenarios that you are...
Sure.
Protecting against?
Some of the more kind of common soundbite answers are things like tax planning, right? Uh, it's if you ask most people, what do you think is going to happen with taxes over the future? Most people would think they're going to go up, not down, right? So even from the simple standpoint of, can I get money into different markets so that if for some reason the dollar collapses, or if for some reason they change tax law because they finally deal with the fact that Social Security is going to be insolvent and they go after wealthy nest eggs, can you protect that by having it in another country? So there's some kind of common financial sound bites about it. There's more qualitative things as well. Let's say, for example, we get into a war, right? Unlikely, hopefully it doesn't happen, but let's say we end up in World War III. South America's probably not going to be included in that, right? It's probably going to be more of a West versus East kind of thing. And South America's just going to be chilling, drinking a margarita while it happens. So some of it is, you know, where do I want to have my nest egg so that I'm diversifying against things like government and legislation and tax risk, economic cycle risk, real estate cycle risk. Even just from a financial return perspective, right? One of the problems in the American economy is low inflation, for example. The economy isn't really growing. The stock market's growing, but it's because the multiples on earnings are going up. The underlying fundamentals of the economy aren't really getting any better.
That meaning, say, you know, it used to be a P/E ratio of 14 or something, right, on a stock might be like, oh, that's about average or right, pretty high or something. And then you have something like Amazon where it's, I don't know, 1,000 or 200.
Amazon's P/E is usually crazy because they have such low earnings ratios that the fractions get screwed up.
Well, they spend all their profits, right?
Yeah, well, and their margins are razor thin. But you look at the market broadly in general, and valuations are very high. Things are very, quote-unquote, expensive right now. People are willing to pay more for a smaller and smaller amount of earnings. And that's partly because of there's so much capital in the world that's looking for places to get returns. And the number of places to get those returns, especially in kind of G20 countries, is decreasing. We see symptoms of this in startup land, for example, which pushes valuations up because private equity doesn't have a lot of places to park their capital anymore. So you look at more of emerging markets, right? Obviously, think of China 15 years ago, right? That would have been a great place to park some money because of the growth and the overhead room that they had to expand. The U.S. isn't really expanding that way anymore, and that's true in almost every industrialized country. Economies are growing, but you hear politicians and economists talk about the quote-unquote new normal, where low growth rates, low inflation, stagnant. Japan is a perfect example of this, right? They had the lost decade, and then it turned into the lost two decades, where things were essentially flat in the 90s and 2000s in Japan. So you look at a market like Colombia or Portugal, and they've had tough times in the past, but they still have a lot of room to grow. And as those economies are maturing and developing, middle classes are forming and growing. There's disposable income. People are starting to buy properties. And that's why you then start to see 7 to 10 to even 15% growth rates compared to 2% in the US.
And so I guess you made some money in tech. You're an investor as well. Mm-hmm. You kind of have a nest egg that you're trying to protect. You've earned a bunch of money and you want to be able to protect that. And so that's one of the reasons why you're diversifying. Is that about right?
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, it's,
so that's your soundbite answer that you were saying, right?
Yeah, there's right. Diversifying your portfolio has been smart forever.
Sure.
The way in which you diversify your portfolio is evolving, right? It used to mean you have more than one stock and
you
more
have
than
IBM,
one.
But you have some,
right. It used to just mean have more than one stock, right? Then it meant have stocks and bonds and real estate. Then it meant have different forms of real estate. Now it includes things like crypto and peer-to-peer lending. And so the nature of diversifying your portfolio continues to evolve as the world evolves. And geographic diversification is just kind of a continuation of that.
Right. I guess I'd like to get into more of why you are, why the diversification from a personal standpoint of your, you know, your physical body. Is this entirely about diversifying money, or is this about your own personal safety as well? Or
I wouldn't say personal safety, but personal life. Absolutely. Right. And that's kind of what I meant by the optimistic side of the answer is this trajectory of defining your life and going where you want to go. Right. And most people used to live, they were born, live and died in their same small town. Right. The world is getting smaller. We've got global citizenship, digital nomads, snowbirds, right? People are moving around. And I want to live in the place that is best for me, where I can have the most satisfied, happy life. And what I've spent part of the last few years doing is exploring that. So what does that mean for me? Where do I go? Where do I fit? Where do I find the most enjoyment? Rather than just assuming it was where I was at the time. I was living in San Francisco, for example, for a long time, doing the Silicon Valley tech stuff. And, you know, San Francisco has its pros and cons. I wasn't unhappy living there, but how did I know that that's where I should be?
And I'm assuming you discovered that it wasn't where you should be?
Yeah, both through the time that I spent there, like working, building companies, being a founder and a CEO and an investor, and then in juxtaposition against the time I've spent in other places around the world. Yeah, I've learned more and more that the San Francisco culture is fine, but not optimal for me.
So how did that happen and what did you discover?
Well, you know, a lot of it happened. So I was an entrepreneur. I started companies. I started a company that moved out to Silicon Valley and did the cliche kind of, you know, I showed up in flip-flops and a hoodie, young white male engineer, had an idea, it starts doing well, I raise a bunch of venture capital, and then build a company, and did that whole kind of cliche.
This was like 2009, 2010?
Yeah, well, I moved out to Silicon Valley. Actually, the day that I moved to Silicon Valley was the day that Lehman Brothers fell in 2008. Oh, so okay. I have perfect timing.
We were like ships in the night. I left July 1st, 2008.
There, so. I showed up 2 months later.
Okay.
The day that I drove into California, Lehman Brothers fell. And, you know, everybody thinks the world is going to collapse. At this point, I had no money for my company. I had traction. Like I had enough. I had started the company in the Midwest, in Indiana. And I had enough traction where I felt like, okay, it's time to go out to the Valley and do this thing. But I moved out there to raise money. I had found an angel investor in the Midwest who agreed to give me a little bit of money that was designed to kind of bridge me out to Silicon Valley. So remember the time frame, right? This is right when things start to collapse. I'm driving across the country. I'm literally in the salt flats in Utah, and I've got a bar signal on my phone. And the investor who was going to give me a little bit of money called me, and we hadn't closed the deal yet. I was in such a rush to get out there that I left as soon as he gave me a verbal. He calls me and he says, look, the markets are going to hell. I'm hearing about this Bernie Madoff guy. My liquidity just went to shit. I can't do it. So I pulled over into a gas station, you know, with all my worldly possessions in the back of my car. And I had to think, like, do I keep going to Silicon Valley or do I turn around, go home and re-enroll in college and, you know, have a big failure sticker on my forehead? I said, no, it's Silicon Valley. Things are going to be great. You know, it's September or whatever. There's still a few months left in the fundraising season before the holidays. It'll be fine. A couple days later, I drive into California, Lehman Brothers falls. Listening to the radio, people are talking about the collapse of, you know, the economy. I'm driving down 101 for the first time. I'm seeing Oracle and Cisco and Google, and I'm kid in a candy store. I was, you know, ear to ear smile. I didn't know where I was going. I had never been to California. I didn't know anybody out there. Silicon Valley is not a place on a map. So I told the GPS, take me to your leader, and drove to Google. So I literally, 3,000 miles later, I drive to Google's headquarters in Mountain View. Get there the day that Lehman Brothers falls. I'm still excited. I'm like, holy wow, I'm in Silicon Valley. Get a hotel, end up getting a crap apartment behind the Walmart in Mountain View. But then because I had no money, because that guy pulled the investment out, I was living on $2.85 a day while the economic world around us was collapsing. And that was the start of my Silicon Valley journey.
How did you get the crappy apartment without money?
Well, I mean, I had a little bit of money and savings,
yeah.
But it turned into a budget of $2.85 a day.
And so how did you cut corners for that budget?
Oh yeah, typical engineer, right? I had to calorie optimize for $2.85. And I ended up finding a particular Jack in the Box fast food combo that got me the most calories for less than $2.
So did you have a spreadsheet of calories per cent?
Yeah, I did.
And where did you collect? Was there like just calorie information on Jack in the Box's website, or where did you collect all this info?
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you can find it online, but otherwise it was just trial and error, right? Going places and looking at menus, and then this is actually what led to getting my big break. So, you know, a lot of these meetups and stuff in the tech community, they have pizza. You know, you go to a networking event at 7 o'clock at night or whatever, and they'll have a few pizzas and sodas or whatever. I would go to a lot of those events primarily for the food, as a way to kind of save money. So, you know, my first few months in the Valley, I'm meeting people, I'm trying to pitch my company and raise an angel investment, but the world has gone to hell and absolutely no funding activity is happening. This is when Sequoia Capital pulled all their CEOs in for that emergency meeting with the RIP Good Times presentation, if you remember that one.
I don't remember that.
Like, things were so scary that Sequoia, it was like an emergency meeting. They said to all their CEOs, get here. We're going to have a meeting. And the title slide on the PowerPoint was a tombstone that said RIP Good Times. And then it leaked out, of course. And the day that presentation leaked out is the day that I signed the lease on that apartment. So I had all these signs from the universe to go home, but was stupid and stubborn and stayed. So I'm going to these events trying to get free food. Nobody is funding my company. I had had 100 no's, rejections. I get to the point in February 2009, I'm about out of money. I've got 2 or 3 weeks left worth of money. I'm not going to be able to make the next rent payment. I'm following Dave McClure on Twitter, and he tweets out a question. I knew the answer to it, so I replied to him. 5 minutes later, I have an email in my inbox from Dave, and it's like, ha ha ha, you're funny. Why don't you come to this dinner for founders that I'm doing tomorrow? And the key word was dinner. So I said yes. I had given up at that point. I'm like, I'm 3 weeks away from being totally broke. This is over. The dream is over. But I'm going to go to this thing and get free food. I go to this event the next day. And you know how at like networking things, people kind of stand in clumps or groups? I see an angel investor standing in a group of people that I had previously pitched and gotten a no. But I see him and I knew him. So I go up and I say hello. And then I leave and go get food, which is what I was there for. Little did I know that one of the other people standing in that clump of people was the lead developer for TechCrunch. And he says to the angel investor that I said hello to, hey, I don't know the new kid. Who is that? He says, oh, his name's John. He's working on this thing that does blah, blah, blah. I didn't know that conversation happened. The next day, I get a phone call from TechCrunch. And they're like, hi, this is TechCrunch. Can you come into our office in an hour? And my first response was, F you, who is, like, this is not a funny joke, right? They're like, no, seriously, come on in. So I get dressed up, which in hindsight was the stupidest thing. I get dressed up, I go into TechCrunch's office. It was the day that they moved out of Michael Harrington's house into their first office. And they only had one desk set up in the middle of the room for the CEO. So I'm this nervous kid. I walk into TechCrunch's office and sit kind of in a chair in the middle of a large room, very interrogation style. And I have no idea what they want to talk about. And then they say, look, we heard about this product that you're working on. We would love to use it. We've actually been looking for something like that.
And what was it? Can you describe it?
It was basically software for direct advertising sales. So as websites like TechCrunch get bigger, they want to rely less on advertising networks like AdSense and the kind of crappy teeth whitening ads and do more premium advertising where TechCrunch will sell an ad campaign directly to Samsung. And that's a very human manual process. Spreadsheets and faxes and fingers on keyboards kind of thing. I made a product that automated that process. So we took a 55-step manual process and turned it into a 1-minute couple-click process.
And TechCrunch obviously wanted to monetize. And so they were excited to talk to you about that. And how'd that go?
Well, they actually were having a public fight with Federated Media at the time, which was kind of an existing ad network for those kind of blogs. And Michael Arrington, being Arrington, was publicly, was kind of airing that dirty laundry in public in this fight with their ad networks and what they were unhappy about. So what they said to me is, we want to ditch our existing ad networks and put all of our revenue on your product. because it's exactly what we've been searching for. And I was terrified because my product at the time was not ready. I did not have a single user. It was not functional. I knew what I was doing, but it was still in development. So I said, no, I was terrified. I was like, the last thing I want to do as the new kid in Silicon Valley is screw up Michael Arrington's income, right? That's a real good way to get kicked out.
Get a bad reputation.
Yeah. So I actually said no. And then I went, and then a couple days later, you know, I go home and I'm, you know, 2 weeks away from insolvency. And I realized, well, what the hell do I have to lose? And they were really cool about it. They said, look, we'll be your first customer. Come work in our office and we'll tell you what we want in the product and we'll be like a perfect beta tester for you. And it wasn't like a customization thing. They wanted exactly what I wanted to build. So it was perfect. And they were super cool about it. Michael and the CEO, Heather, without their coolness and support for being willing to take like a kid from the Midwest and put their revenue on him, that's what led to everything that I've had since. So I ended up saying yes. I worked in their office for about 2 months to get that product ready, and we launched. And the way that startup launched was Michael Arrington wrote a blog post called "So Long, Federated Media, Thanks for All the Fish."
Oh, wow.
And he kind of concluded his public battle with their existing ad networks by saying, we're breaking up with you and using this new company that, by the way, nobody's ever heard of before because it's launching today. And P.S., they're fundraising.
And so were you just kind of taking a cut of their ad revenue? Was that how you saved yourself from insolvency?
Actually, I did it for them for free, right? It was important enough. Things were so bad, right? It's 2009. There were legitimate arguments that startups and venture capital were going to go away, right? There was that kind of fear in the environment. So the value of getting a lighthouse customer like TechCrunch was worth not charging them $100 a month or whatever it would have been.
But you were 2 weeks away from insolvency.
So. I was. So what I was able to do is I was able to leverage it into an angel round.
Within 2 weeks?
Yeah, exactly. Somebody reached out to me on Twitter and said, hey, we heard you're doing this deal. He took me to dim sum because, again, I still needed free food. And that was on a Friday, and he wired us $25,000 on Monday.
What were you telling yourself when you were living on $285 a day and the universe was telling you to go back to Indiana? What was the internal monologue or dialogue, depending on how many personalities you have?
Depends on who you ask. You know, I don't distinctly remember any kind of productive monologue, right? I was irrationally stubborn and stupid, right? You kind of have to be to do these extremely high risk, high reward kind of entrepreneurial paths. And I think entrepreneurs that like sit in the chair that I'm sitting in now and say, oh, I knew it in my gut. I had the belief and the perseverance. Right? I think they're lying. It's confirmation survivor bias, right? Like I was terrified. But I also at the same time knew that if everything fell apart and I failed, I'd still be okay. Right. And that has to do with some of this narrative around why entrepreneurship is becoming, especially Silicon Valley style entrepreneurship, is becoming more of a luxury for people of means and background. Because if you screw up and you fail, you've got a safety net. And I didn't come from means, but I believed enough in my abilities. I could go back and finish my degree. Worst case scenario.
Wait, you dropped out of college?
Yeah, I dropped out my senior year to move out to the Valley. Yeah. I was six courses away from two degrees, and I was stupid enough to do them in parallel. So when I dropped out with one semester left, I didn't have enough for either of the degrees.
You dropped out with one semester left.
Yeah.
And what did everybody have to say about that?
I don't remember because I didn't care. I remember my conversation with my parents, and I had been entrepreneurial. This was my third company. So I started a company in high school and a second company my freshman year of college. So my parents were used to it. And when I called them and told them that I was going to drop out, you know, they asked me some questions like, why do you think that this is the right decision? What kind of validation do you have that this is the gamble that you want to put your chips on? And when I explained it to them, they said, well, okay, you know, we support you.
So the sky is falling, the economy is crumbling, lots of people go to grad school or college to hide from a bad market, and you drop out of college. to start a company?
Well, you know, what's funny is in hindsight, with the way that everything worked, because I would have graduated university in 2008. All of my graduating class ended up being the class that was fundamentally screwed by the financial crisis, right? Most of the kids in my peers in business school, they had job offers from Goldman Sachs and that kind of stuff. And they were going to go to Chicago. They were going to go to New York and do those kinds of finance and consulting jobs. At the when I dropped out and moved, did this Silicon Valley thing, they were saying to me, oh, you're so stupid. We've got $200,000 a year starting salaries. You're living on $2.85 a day. Ha ha, you moron. They almost all of them ended up not even starting their job because in the months that followed graduation with the financial crisis, all their offers got pulled. And we see in the data in the 10 years since that the graduating class in that 2008-2009 timeframe have had an artificially depressed career growth and salary growth trajectory because of entering the job market in that horrible window.
As I understand it, that kind of never goes away.
No, it's perpetual. Their lifetime earnings, the graduating class of 08-09, their lifetime earnings are projected to always be lower than classes before and after that time period. So in hindsight, it ended up being okay. And then of course, because what I did in Silicon Valley ended up being successful, that ended up being okay. But you know, my parents were fine with it. I believed in it. I felt like, you know, I do this. I am an entrepreneur. I want to go do it. I understand the risk. I've always been eyes wide open about it. But knowing that even if everything went wrong, I'd still be okay was part of the kind of safety net that gave me the confidence to go roll the dice and do it.
So you raised an angel round. And then in 2009, you were the youngest person to raise venture capital.
Yeah. So some people in the press told me that I was the youngest entrepreneur in the world to raise venture capital.
During
the financial crisis period. I was 23.
So you had the angel round from the TechCrunch thing, yeah. And then you raised VC after that. You had clients, you had TechCrunch. I believe that you were doing ads on Tim Ferriss's blog as well.
So we ended up basically kind of managing the advertising for all the big tech blogs like Mashable, VentureBeat, TechCrunch, GigaOm. Other folks like Tim Ferriss's blog, we did the website, the advertising for.
And then eventually you sold that company.
Yeah, that company got acquired a few years ago now.
And if you are in Silicon Valley and you're successful, you make a bunch of money. Now, obviously, you have to go be a venture capitalist.
Right.
Right. Or what do most people do in that position? And it doesn't sound like you took that path.
Yeah, there's this is an example of some of where my criticisms come in about Silicon Valley, right? Is it's supposed to be this utopia of contrarianism and alternative paths, not only being okay, but being celebrated. And they pat themselves on the back about that a lot, but it's extremely homogenous. I don't just mean in terms of things like race and sex. I mean, even in terms of thought or career path. So given that I was a late 20s, successfully exited founder, CEO in a startup, there's a particular path that you're supposed to take after that. So for example, the day after the company was acquired, there was an investor that basically offered me a blank check. He's like, here's $1 million. What's the next company going to be? It's this kind of myth of the serial founder where, you know, this kind of crushing it narrative of, oh, I already know what my next company is going to be. The day after my last project ends, I'm starting the next one. And I had them say to me, so, okay, what's next? You know, let's go. What are you going to do? Are you going to start a new company? Are you going to become a venture capitalist? And I said, first of all, I'm burnt out and I don't know. I was a solo founder that worked my ass off through the recession over 6 or 7 years, built a company, did that whole thing. And without any drug support, right? A lot of the founder CEOs in the Valley have to rely on a lot of supplements and drugs to get through the day and survive. I was drug free. I was a solo founder. A lot of hard times. My mother died during that time. The recession was tough. So I was burnt out. And all I wanted to do was get healthy and recover. And I didn't know what the next project would be. We see in the data that this myth of the serial entrepreneur is fake, right? If it doesn't work, it's easier for them to raise money because of social proof and connections and things like this. But they don't end up creating more successful companies at large compared to quote unquote first time entrepreneurs.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's part of the oligarchy, right? If you're plugged in and you have success under your belt, that makes people feel like you're an easier gamble or a safer gamble. But in the data, it doesn't show that. There are, of course, wonderful serial entrepreneurs, right? People that have success after success, but those are the exception that prove the rule. So I was burnt out. I didn't have the motivation for a new company. I don't think you should start a company unless you have a reason to, like a real reason to, not just somebody wants to hand you money to do it. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to do venture scale software in Silicon Valley. During the time that I was actively, you know, the founder CEO of this company, so circa 2009 to 2014, right? We're coming out of the recession and the next boom of startups happened, right? Kind of it went from really bad in 2009, 2010 to then things got really good and hot for the next 5 years, right? When you started having companies like Airbnb and Dropbox and Uber, and things went from really bad to really good. I had been one of the more vocally outspoken kind of venture-backed CEOs in the Valley, saying to the community and amongst ourselves, guys, we're working on a lot of stupid shit. Like we are putting our amazing collective problem-solving power on delivering a burrito in less than 7 minutes. Meanwhile, there's all these other problems in the world that need to be solved. They're not being solved. Our Silicon Valley process can be used to solve those problems. Why aren't we doing that? How can we create more entrepreneurs in more places? How can we diversify beyond these bullshit phone applications? So when the company got acquired and I'm thinking about what to do, it was multiple birds, one stone. I knew I was burnt out and I needed to get healthy and just take time off. Go see grandma, go to the gym, sleep, that kind of thing. I knew I wanted to go get motivation for what the next thing is, right? Have a reason to do a next company or a next project. And I wanted to put my money where my mouth was about that problem. You know, how can we have other Silicon Valleys? How can we have more entrepreneurs in more places working on different problems? So I decided, I sold everything that I own in San Francisco. I had a few boxes of mementos that I put in storage and I had a carry-on backpack. And I left and I traveled the world full-time for about 2.5 years to do achieve these multiple goals, to figure out almost like split testing a product, but split testing life. What kind of work do I want to do and where do I want to be to do it? Are there different cultures that work? So most people have heard of product market fit, for example. And then some people have heard of founder market fit. I thought of it as like founder cities, founder country fit. You know, where do I want to live and do the kind of work that I want to do? How do I know that it's San Francisco if I haven't gone and tried it in Tokyo? And then lastly, some altruism, right? One of the wonderful things about Silicon Valley and why Silicon Valley is what it is this kind of circle of life of knowledge sharing, mentorship, angel investing, right? If you're successful in Silicon Valley, it's expected that you then pay it back. And that's good. That's a wonderful thing about Silicon Valley. And one of the things that's missing in most ecosystems outside of Silicon Valley. And I cared a lot about that. I've always had this place in my heart for people outside of places like San Francisco or New York that have this ambition, have this talent and intelligence.
Does it have to do with growing up in Indiana?
Yeah, part of it, right? You know, like when I was trying to build my startup in Indiana, I was pitching quote-unquote angel investors who were dentists and gas station owners, or they made their money building a textile factory 50 years ago. And you know, kind-hearted people, but two apples and oranges, right? And actually, the thing that finally got me to move out to Silicon Valley, I was pitching one of the top angel investors in the Midwest. I worked my way up the ladder to this godfather of angel investing in the Midwest. And this is in 2008. And I'm talking about APIs, which was part of what made my product special at the time. And he interrupts me and he goes, I just learned about blogging. How does what you're doing jive with that? It was 2008, right? Blogging was not a new thing. And you know, I was kind and answered, but in my mind, I'm like, all right, that's it. I'm done.
And something I think isn't talked about very much was just, I mean, we're both from the United States, which is great.
Right.
But I'm from Nebraska. You're from Indiana. And it's kind of tough to make it in Silicon Valley or whatever when you come from those places. It's a different environment.
It totally is. I actually grew up near Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. I went to school in Indiana. But even the fact that I lived in Indiana for the rest of my days, I had venture capitalists, for example, call me their farm boy. Or I always tried to be really ethical. I was always very honest with people in business, and they'd say to me almost kind of smug, like, oh, there's those farm values. You know, isn't that cute?
Yeah.
You're going to get chewed up and spit out.
You got Indiana University on your LinkedIn profile, yeah, and right. It's not Harvard. It's not Stanford or whatever. So,
which was, you know, I even had to convince, like, the program that I went to at IU was the third ranked in the country. It was ahead of some of those Ivy League schools. But of course, nobody ever believed that. And there was such a kind of a prejudice about it that even if I brought up, hey, look at the ranking of the program I went to, they'd still think like, oh yeah, that's cute, farm boy.
What's funny is that a lot of successful entrepreneurs / engineers came from Illinois,
yeah,
or Illinois University. like, the whole Yelp team,
right,
pretty much was from there.
Mark Andreessen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Which, at least there's Chicago really close by, which Indiana is really close to Chicago, but I think people don't think of it that way.
No, when I was trying to, there was a phase where before I decided to move to Silicon Valley, because I was actually kind of anti-Silicon Valley. I was like, oh, those echo chamber idiots, they don't know how to create real value, right? They're working on social networks for dead people. And it's like, okay, but right. And that problem still exists today. It's quite a little echo chamber of silly stuff. And I was kind of anti-Silicon Valley at the time. So I thought I would go to Chicago. And I started making the eight hour round trip to go to Chicago to pitch people. But this was pre Groupon and before some of the recent success in Chicago, and the ecosystem just wasn't ready for it. It was basically no better than Indiana. So at the time, I either had to go to San Francisco or New York for my company to have any chance at all.
So you sell your company, you decide that you want to travel around the world, learn a little bit about what kind of life works for you or place works for you. You'd like to spread entrepreneurship around the world. Where's the first place that you go?
The first place I went to Europe first, and I landed in Athens.
And why Athens? Well, actually, I went on a mentor trip through the organization you started.
Nomadic Mentors.
Nomadic Mentors.
Yeah, exactly.
I went to Athens.
Yeah. You spoke at the accelerator in Athens. That was the very first accelerator that I spoke at in my travels.
Oh, cool.
So, because I was living in a carry-on backpack, I had to travel based on weather, right? So, like, I started in Southern Europe at a time, like, and then moved more north as things got warmer.
No winter clothes.
Right. I had no winter clothes. So I was traveling partly based on the seasons, and I started in Southern Europe and moved more towards Northern Europe. So I landed in Athens, and 2 or 3 days in, I'd done the sightseeing stuff, and I'm thinking, okay, what's happening in the local startup ecosystem here? Is there a startup ecosystem here? And I already knew from the news that that was the time period that Greece was really having problems. This was when austerity was happening, and there was 40% unemployment. Garbage is piling up on the streets. So I'm like, okay, you know, entrepreneurship is the mechanism through which people can elevate themselves, can pull themselves out of these bad economic situations. I enjoy mentoring. I like hanging out with startup founders. Let's see what I can do. So I literally Googled about what was happening in the startup scene. And there had been a New York Times article a few weeks earlier about that accelerator in Athens, which was in the Dutch embassy. It was actually paid for by the Dutch government.
Orange Grove.
Yeah, Orange Grove, exactly. It was the Northern European countries knew that the Southern European countries were pissed off about austerity. So at the same time that they were kind of enforcing these austerity measures, they were then also trying to do economic development programs. And so I just walked into this Orange Grove accelerator and said, hi, I'm John. This is my background. I'd love to help how I can. Do you have entrepreneurs that could use mentorship or something like that? And that's what got that whole thing kickstarted.
And then how did you get to the point where you decided that you wanted to start something like Nomadic Mentors?
So, because I wanted to travel to these spots around the world that had entrepreneurial opportunity, right? I'm not going to move into the middle of nowhere. So even though I wanted to go explore these different areas, they still had to be qualified, right? So whether they had an ecosystem or accelerators or something. And what happened was, as I started doing more of this mentorship and this ecosystem building, it turned out I had a knack for it. And, you know, somebody running an accelerator in Belgrade, Serbia would say, hey,
we'll another get, accelerator that I another, went
to. Yeah, exactly, man. Exactly. So they, you know, they'd say, hey, we'll buy you a plane ticket and a hotel room, come over for a week, spend a few days hanging out with our startups and teaching. And it was great because it subsidized some of my travel and I got to hang out with startup people. You know, I don't want to hang out with Eat, Pray, Love people in a hostel, right? Thinking that they're somehow worldly because they, you know, are living in a hostel. I want to hang out with startup people. They're my favorite people. So I got to help them and that felt really good. I got to learn a lot from them because when you teach, you learn, especially in this startup world. And it subsidized some of my travel and it was wonderful. And as I did that more and more and more, I started seeing that a lot of the challenges that these ecosystems were facing were the same. It's easy for anywhere in the world, Belgrade, Serbia, they can open up a co-working space. They can open up an accelerator. One of the pieces that was missing in a lot of these ecosystems is that kind of tradecraft knowledge, the kind of the knowledge that's passed down from master to apprentice, right? Like pitch mechanics. You know, you can't teach how to pitch a startup in a book. You can try, but it doesn't work. I learned how to pitch startups really well by being in Silicon Valley, getting feedback from people, watching Steve Jobs, watching Ashton Kutcher get on stage and pitch his startup at TechCrunch 50 and bomb. You know, and that is how I learned how to do that. And these ecosystems outside of San Francisco, New York, and so on, they have that chicken and the egg problem. And the only way to overcome it in a short amount of time is to import.
The missing chicken being the accomplished entrepreneurs who have the masters
to hand down the knowledge to the next generation of apprentices. So you have to import that. And a lot of these ecosystems around the world knew that. They knew, for example, in Athens, they had mentors from the local community in Greece. And those mentors meant well. They were volunteering their time. Their heart was in the right place. But they were a VP of marketing at a beer company or whatever. And I literally saw some of these local mentors say to a startup that had 25,000 euros in funding, you need to spend 20,000 of that on a launch marketing campaign. Because that's what made sense in their textile factory or whatever. So these ecosystems had this chicken and the egg problem for the master apprentice tradecraft knowledge. They need to import it. They know that they need to import it. But they had nowhere to go. You know, what I was doing was very ad hoc. I knew a guy who ran the accelerator in Serbia. And I was willing to do that work and for each one, do the work and tell them my background and recreate the process every time. After doing that for a year or two, I'm thinking, okay, how can I make this more scalable? Right? This clearly, I saw the impact it was having. Like it was black and white. I knew that these ecosystems desperately wanted to import that kind of knowledge and talent. And I believed that there was more people like me, founders typically in the in-between period after they've sold a company or after a company failed, where they want to travel and speak and pay it back and help the next generation of entrepreneurs. The problem was that they couldn't find each other. So it was quite simple, actually. So we created a matchmaking service, and I set it up as a nonprofit. It's called Nomadic Mentors, and built the highest quality curated group of traveling startup mentors in the world. It's about 100 people, mostly successful founders and innovators from places like Silicon Valley. Collectively, those mentors have raised about $4 billion in venture capital, and they're willing to get on an airplane and fly to Athens and teach the next generation of entrepreneurs. So we basically just became a matchmaking service. We screened the mentors, we screened the hosts, and we connect them. And as a result, we've directly impacted over 20,000 entrepreneurs. We've had mentors go to, I think, 70 countries at this point. And it's been wonderfully fantastic.
And there's a lot of governments that have been doing things to try to spur entrepreneurship. I believe you've worked with some of them. Just one example, there's the Startup Chile program. I don't know if you've done anything with them, but wasn't theirs was basically come to Chile, start a company. We will give you $30,000, I believe it was last I saw. Yeah. And then the expectation then is that you are going to maybe do some local mentoring of people there in Chile.
Yeah.
Are there any other programs that you know of or governments who were doing interesting things to spur entrepreneurship?
Yeah, absolutely. So I ended up, these few years that I was doing this, what's called innovation design work, ecosystem building, basically, I would work with accelerators, universities, NGOs, things like Startup Weekend, and certainly governments at various levels. Sometimes, for example, in Northern Italy, there's a city called Trento, and the city government put a lot of money into that program. Or the Berlin city government has done a fantastic job. Sometimes it's at the state or the federal level, or even at the United Nations level. Startup Chile was a great program. And an early example of actually this whole theme that you and I are talking about. Startup Chile understood the world is shrinking.
Wait, is Startup Chile done? Is that still going on?
It has had some problems. And that's actually another example of government problems, because even when you find a politician that thinks, hey, we should do something about this. Let's create a startup program. Let's build a startup ecosystem. What they don't typically understand is that it takes a long time, right? Even if you do everything right, you import talent, you funnel money into it, it still takes a few years or much longer, right? Silicon Valley developed over 150 years, going back to the gold rush in the 1840s. You can't parachute into a place like Santiago, Chile and say, we're going to go from nothing to a fully successful ecosystem in 5 years. You can't do it. And what happened is new politicians get elected. They need something to get riled up about. They say, oh, we've spent $30 million on this program. What, we haven't created the next Google yet. We're going to shut it down. So.
And I remember I went to speak in Chile once and I was visiting some Startup Chile people there, but also I was being warned, oh, don't go to this subway station because there's going to be tear gas. And it was because the students were protesting having, I guess, lack of resources in their schools. So it was a little, there was a little irony there. I wasn't sure how to feel about the fact that there was this Startup Chile thing where they were giving money to these outside entrepreneurs. At least optically, that would look kind of bad.
Right. And it's optics, right? That's why it's easy. Then a new class of politicians comes in. It's easy to point at things like ecosystem investments and say,
that's not creating jobs, though it very well might create jobs and be better off than money invested.
Yeah. We know that successful entrepreneurial ecosystems are one of, if not the best way for a country to overcome those problems, to pull themselves out of poverty. But in that kind of growth transition phase, it's hard for people to understand.
So do you have examples? How do we know that?
Oh, just across the, I mean, you look, so for example, the UN, the WHO, you know, they publish data about global poverty rates. And we know that post-World War II, one of the most optimistic charts that we have as a species is the number of people that have come out of poverty in the last decades. The forces that make that happen are wealth creation, entrepreneurship, business creation, job creation, right? And it gets embodied in different ways. So if you're familiar with microfinancing, like the Grameen Bank and all that, because that's the whole point. The whole point is we're going to give a poor woman in Africa $300 to start a basket weaving business, because that is dollar for dollar one of, if not the highest leverage ways to improve things, especially sustainably, rather than teach a man to fish rather than just give him a food aid. Right. So that's why things like microfinancing happen. That's why governments around the world are so invested in creating more entrepreneurial, innovative, problem-solving economies rather than just being receivers of aid.
Right. And you ended up being the innovation advisor to the Obama White House. How did that end up happening? That seems like I wouldn't know how the steps would look to end up in a position like that.
Yeah. So I'm traveling around the world. I'm doing all this ecosystem building work. Turns out I had a pretty good knack for it. ended up doing a lot of work with governments. Like I was working with a lot of Northern European governments at the time, Germany, Holland, Sweden, France. At the same time, one of the best things I think about the Obama administration was they understood that they needed to change the culture and change the DNA around some of the way Washington works. And this was the silver lining to the healthcare.gov website fiasco. That website was such a disaster, and it was such a public crisis disaster that it kind of smacked Washington in the mouth and got them to admit, we're pretty bad at this technology thing. We happen to have one of the best communities in the world at this at technology. Maybe we should have a relationship with them. Because in contrast, if you think about other major industries in America, like finance, auto, pharma, defense, the relationship between those industries and Washington are way too close, right? It's a corrupt revolving door, right? Ajit Pai is a Verizon lawyer. Now he's the head of the FCC and dismantling net neutrality to serve Verizon, right? We had no relationship like that with Silicon Valley, which is what leads to politicians fundamentally not understanding technology. So Obama said, hey, well, let's build that bridge, right? Like let's actually have a relationship with this industry that frankly is one of the biggest, best things we have going on in America. After the healthcare website, 2012, 2013, 14, the first low-hanging fruit step was let's fix websites. We fixed the healthcare website. Now let's sprinkle some of that Silicon Valley website magic onto things like immigration forms and veterans scheduling a doctor appointment without having a 6-month wait time and they die in the meantime. So wonderful. Couple years, they create these programs like the U.S. Digital Service and 18F, where they're fixing websites. About 2015, President Obama, the CTO, a guy named Todd Park, and the CIO, DJ Patil, they're thinking, fixing websites is great. How do we go deeper? How do we create genetic, cultural, procedural change so that Washington functions a little bit more like Silicon Valley in terms of solving problems, not building websites, but solving problems, whether it's education or healthcare or whatever. And to do that, they wanted to bring in more kind of Silicon Valley founder CEO kind of talent. Todd Park, the CTO of the United States, his job was to go find those people. I was starting to feel like I was ready to stop traveling. So I wanted to stop the backpacking. I wanted to get back into capitalist mode. And
roughly 4 years of traveling, right?
About two and a half. Yeah, about 2.5. So I did 30 countries in a little over 2 years, which was wonderful. I mean, there's nothing to complain about. It was fantastic, but I was getting a little itchy. I wanted to really work on something, create something. I got connected with the CTO, Todd Park. We started having conversations. It was great.
How did you get connected with him?
I started sharing with just my personal network that I was thinking about getting back to work. And one of them had worked at 18F, one of these kind of new tech agencies in Washington, and said, oh, absolutely. We want, you know, in some way we want you. And then, you know, met a person, and it filtered up to
putting those feelers out as something for people to do if they're looking to change careers or change jobs or something like that, is just email your network and let them know what you're up to. So.
Yeah, exactly. It was just human. It's just, hey, this is what I've been doing. This is my goal. Do you have any thoughts? And one of those friends said, yeah, you should talk to XYZ. And that led down the chain to meeting Todd Park, the CTO. We clicked. We're talking about all these things that he cared about, that they're the President Obama's goals with changing culture and DNA. And it was just such a good fit with this innovation design work that I'd been doing. And I had always had kind of an affinity for public service and the you know, you want to go and help improve the world. And Silicon Valley does that in one way, but it always feels kind of incomplete. So, okay, let's see if we can go do it at the federal government. And I was actually in the process of immigrating to Amsterdam at the time. I had decided that I was going to go live full-time and work in Northern Europe. I fell in love with the ecosystem. The entrepreneurs were great. I was a better cultural fit in Northern Europe than in San Francisco. So I started that process. 2 months after I basically immigrated to Amsterdam, I signed a lease. I was actually about to become a venture capitalist at a new fund in Amsterdam and Berlin. 2 months after I start that process, I get a call from the White House. They're like, we want you to come do this. Of course you say yes.
So was it President Obama calling you directly?
No, although they, no joke, they told me, we'll do what we have to do to make it happen. If you need a call from the president to know that we're serious, we'll make that happen.
I would answer yes to that question.
I would have felt so sheepish.
You're kind of wasting the country's resources.
Yeah, we're just like I don't, you know, it's not about me feeling important. You know what? Sure. The reason they offered it is because so much of the good talent that we would want to work in Washington don't, because they believe it's futile. Right? It's going to be an awful nightmare. You're going to beat your head against the wall and not get anything done. They were offering to people like me for the president to call them to recruit them as a way to show them, we're serious about this. You're going to get the top cover that you need to, you know, with like a machete to cut through the red tape. And the president will show you that we are serious about that.
Was that true?
The short answer is yes, it was true, actually. And that was the whole reason I even went. Was because I knew by doing this innovation design government reform work, and I had touched the U.S. federal government before. I had done a little bit of work with the Startup Visa Act. I had some previous experience on Capitol Hill in Washington, an internship, and I knew that it was so important that in order to fix anything in government, you have to have top cover. Like a lot of the good stuff that Obama got done, the only reason it happened is because he was willing to get on the phone with people and say, this is what I wanted to happen. Get out of the way or you're fired. And that's what any good leader should do. But in the Washington machine, people with power do everything they can not to use it, right? It's all politics and subtlety and backroom stuff. A leader like a president saying to a lifelong middle manager bureaucrat, this is what I want, get out of the way. It's unusual.
So what were good things that came out of that?
So the main project that I worked on ended up being for the Defense Department. So we started with a very blank whiteboard, right? We know that we want to create deeper institutional change in government. What does that mean? How do we do that? Especially how do we do that with only about a year and a half left in the administration? No real ability to pass new laws, pass new budgets. So with those constraints, how do we accomplish this goal? That lent itself towards the Defense Department because they've got the largest budget. As soon as you use words like saving troops or counterterrorism, things tend to happen more quickly. And they had a new Secretary of Defense who was a really cool guy. This was Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. He was a physicist by background, had spent time in Silicon Valley and kind of good Ivy League universities, but then also ran the procurement department of the Pentagon, right? They've got an $800 billion a year budget. He ran that whole mess and then became the Secretary of Defense. So he was the right person combined with President Obama being the right person. They said, let's exploit this opportunity to create some real change. And we focused on the technology that we use for defense, because still to this day, part of our nuclear codes are run on floppy disks, right? Like, it's woefully outdated. When you and I were kids, we'd watch a movie and government would have like fancy technology. And we'd think, well, if we have, you know, this product as a civilian, imagine how much further the government have, right? That's the way it was when we were kids. It's no longer the case. It's the opposite now, right? They've got woefully outdated tech. They can't hire engineers. It's just awful. I was very interested in getting the public sector and the private innovation world back together, kind of like the golden era of the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, when the government working with the private sector created the internet, created GPS, right? These things that have created so much wealth and improvement in life in the last couple of decades, that happened when those two worlds worked together. But in the last 40 years, they separated and it was almost like a divorce and they never talked to each other again. Right? Which is what resulted in government having such bad technology and not understanding the modern world, like the internet, and vice versa. It's what resulted in Silicon Valley working on Tinder and burrito delivery applications. because
and that part being because there's red tape everywhere that they try to do something. Is that
partly, but even just because of the financial incentives, right? Like venture capital, you know, that ecosystem specialized for 18-month funding cycles for WhatsApp, Instagram type businesses, not 15-year long. We're gonna take 15 years to develop LiDAR so that we can do self-driving cars, right? There is a window of work and types of work that when all you have is a private sector profit motive, that stuff's going to be ignored. Like if you are a startup founder and you go pitch a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, I'm going to try to fix education. They'll laugh at you and throw you out, right? That overlap in the Venn diagram, when the private innovation world and the public sector work together, that's when magic happened on some of these big fundamental issues: climate change, healthcare, education, whatever. Silicon Valley has gotten better in the last few years about working on some of those projects. But you rewind a few years ago, that's why I said I was one of the outspoken CEOs saying, why Tim O'Reilly was, other people were, why aren't we working on this stuff? Part of it was because of the lack of money that would support those kinds of projects. And part of it was the gap that existed between the innovation world and the government world. I wanted to close that gap and get more money crossing between the two worlds. So working with the Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon, there was a program that they wanted to build called the Defense Innovation Unit, or DIUX. They had a very kind of cliche government understanding of what that program would be. Like, governments are horrible across the board at solving problems, especially problems that have to do with entrepreneurship and innovation, because it's almost like an alien language to them, right? It's the Chile example. Oh, we're going to sprinkle some, we're going to give money to founders for a few years, but then 3 years later, they look at their watch and say, we don't have a Google yet, so this, we're going to shut this whole thing down. Governments just aren't good at this.
That's ironic, considering that, I guess, think you were talking about things taking a long time if the government is going to work on innovation. And
right.
So.
Yeah, exactly. Government has its own version of the Wall Street quarterly earnings problem, right? That's why they talk so much about the first 100 days of a presidency, because now already we're now starting to get into lockdown for the 2018 midterm elections, right? So they're thinking on election cycles. They're thinking sound bites. They're thinking, how do I get reelected? They're thinking optics and politics. So to actually solve these problems, like an entrepreneurship problem or a technology problem, government's really bad at it, really, really bad. Which is why it was so cool that President Obama and the Secretary of Defense and CTO Todd Park, some of these people understood, in order to actually solve these problems, we can't do it the same way that we've always done it. We need to get different types of people, like a 30-year-old flip-flop wearing, you know, burner from San Francisco.
You.
Yeah. Who certainly does not act and look and talk or think like a typical DCer. They understood, well, if we want to have a different result, we have to do things differently. Because there had literally been 12 or 13 programs in the Pentagon over the last 20 years just to solve this problem. And every single one of them failed. So they finally realized the right people got into the right positions of power, like president, with the right circumstances to say, we're going to give this a legitimate shot. And they were willing to work with someone like me, who had in to their ears some pretty crazy ideas. But to their credit, they listened. So I worked into this project. They said, hey, we have this thing. It's not working. Can you fix it? So I flew back to the United States. I went to this office that had existed for about 2 months at this point. At first, the goal was to give them advice on how to fix it. Hey, these guys are off track. Maybe you can do your mentorship thing and help get them back on track. Things were so bad that 3 days later, the CTO and I are sitting in the Secretary of Defense's office in the Pentagon saying, we need to kill your baby in the crib. It's not going to work. But the good news is we can do it right. And to their credit, they listened to it. They said, okay, go. So that was my full-time project. I basically re-architected this program, relaunched it, and it's been extremely successful since. In fact, it's now considered one of the most successful government innovation programs in the world.
Still running.
Still, yeah, it's been going for about 18 months at this point.
So what sort of things is it doing?
It's kind of like a venture capital arm for the Pentagon, but they don't invest in companies by law. One of the constraints was we had to figure out how can we give money to startups without investing in them, right? Long story short, we found some legislative hacks to get around that. There was even a law from the Eisenhower era that had been on the books since then, but nobody really used it because they were afraid to use it, right? People, you know, the professional bureaucrats, they don't want to lose their job. So they weren't willing to take risks and even use these laws that had existed for 60 years to help, but just sat on the shelf collecting dust. We found them, dusted them off, and applied them. And across the board said, how do we create magnetism? Like, it's not enough to have a government program because everybody in Silicon Valley is going to say, oh, yet another crappy, you know, hollow government program. I'm not going to bother meeting with them. We had to put our money where our mouth was and do something really bold. So we now have, or this group now has an office in Silicon Valley that acts like a venture capital firm. They are finding startups, meeting founders, understanding what's happening in the world. It's half military people and half innovation people. So for example, I recruited one of the leaders from Google X, their lab, who now runs this military group. And they'll meet a startup that's working on an interesting problem that the government wants to subsidize, but they're willing to think about it differently than a typical venture capitalist, right? That typical venture capitalist is thinking, how is this going to get to the next round of funding in 12 months? Is it going to have a $1 billion exit? The government is thinking, does this solve a problem that we care about? And are we willing to put money into it? So they'll meet a startup and they'll give a startup $1 million, $5 million. And it's done in average from first meeting to money in the bank in 55 days, commercial 2-page contracts, none of the government crap, no audits. You don't have to fill out forms that, that swear that your second cousin isn't in the Russian military. You don't have to do any of that stuff. And it's working. They are solving real problems for our soldiers with hand in hand with the technology sector through creating relationships, taking those startups out onto battleships. I'll give you a real example. This program took Eric Schmidt, the former CEO and chairman of Google, out to a naval battleship. One of the functions, and just said, walk around. We're not going to give you a 100-page document, you know, an RFP, government form. We're going to let you do what Silicon Valley does. We're going to give you free rein to this battleship. Go find problems to solve that you know can be solved. What Schmidt ended up seeing was there was this room with a couple, you know, naval service members in it who coordinated refueling missions. And it was all done by paper. And Schmidt was like, this, like literally with giant boards with schedules and tankers. And Schmidt was like, this is stupid. This is a problem that should absolutely be software-ized. They did it. They did it in like 2 months, which normally to do something like that in the government process would take 5 years and $300 million. Through this kind of working with the private sector path, they got it done in 2 months for, I don't know, $2 million. It was implemented. All of the operations and service members on that ship are happier. Their job is easier. Things are going. And it's going to save the American taxpayer $1 billion from the inefficiency that was solved with software.
So I imagine a program like this, it was kind of strategically aimed at the Pentagon or the military.
Yeah.
And it's being successful. Hmm. Will this be replicated in other parts of the government?
It could be, but we ran out of time and the administration changed. So for example, I was done with that project with about 6 months left in the Obama administration. And I started looking at a next project that had to do with fixing education. Decided we just don't have enough time to get it done within this administration. And then things happened the way that they happened and we had a new administration and they basically shut down all of these efforts. The program that I created, DIUX, is one of the few things that Trump has kept. But by and large, they've been very anti Silicon Valley. Almost all the good people that had come in under President Obama are now gone. either because they were fired or through attrition.
But at least your program continues at this,
it
at
does.
This point.
Yeah, it's doing very well.
And it sounds like you have a lot of purpose to the things that you've been doing doing lately. You know, you worked at the White House. You worked on helping innovation around the world. Now you have this project, The Prepared. And it is, I don't know how to say that you're a sane prepper. Okay. Cause I've seen like a prepping shows, like prepping reality TV shows. And there are these crazy people on them, but the prepared is disaster preparedness. I went and looked at the writing. It's fantastic writing. And so it makes me wonder, there seems to be so much purpose to what you do. What caused you to end up doing this?
Yeah, so I was actually one of the first kind of outed preppers in Silicon Valley. And if for those of you listening, if you're not familiar with the word prepper, it's almost become kind of a dirty word for doomsday preppers, people that, based on what you see on TV, like those shows that you talked about, David, people that are, they might have a nuclear bunker, or they're move out to the country and get off the grid because they're worried about societal collapse, things like this. That movement started about 10 years ago. So when the financial crisis happened and President Obama got elected, there was a group of people that over time became known as the alt-right that legitimately thought the Federal Reserve was going to steal their money and President Obama was a Muslim secret agent that was going to enact Sharia law and steal their children. And a very small vocal minority group of people started creating like militias, and they called themselves doomsday preppers. And that became kind of a subculture. But what has happened over time is that it's gone a lot more mainstream. Every intelligent people, normal, everybody, all walks of life have realized things like climate change, natural disasters, job loss, car accidents, all of these things are emergencies that we can better prepare for because we've become so complacent in our life, right? We've lost 250,000 years worth of skills, survival skills, in less than 100, right? Most people don't know how to start a fire. Most people don't know how to dress a wound. Most people, if they see a car accident, the best they'll do is Instagram it, right? I've been a prepper for a long time because the same mindset and skills that helped me be good at Silicon Valley stuff, problem solving stuff, are the same skills and viewpoint that helped me understand that we are not solving some of these really big problems like climate change or economic decline, wealth inequality. And this is why Silicon Valley is prepping, right? That's been a big thing in the news in the last year since the inauguration is the rise of Silicon Valley preppers. And a lot of people in the press think it's contradictory. They're like, well, wait a second. You guys are liberal. You know, you're rich. You live good lives. You are about saving the world and changing the world, blah, blah, blah. You're the complete opposite of a bearded redneck watching Fox News in the woods. But what they don't understand is that Silicon Valley is not about code. Silicon Valley is about problem solving. It is one of the world's best problem solving engines. And it's that same viewpoint and that same talent that leads people in Silicon Valley to look at things like government, recognize that it's fundamentally broken. Not that they disagree with an administration's policies, but the entire engine of government is broken and probably not fixable. So they start preparing for it. It's like an insurance policy. People are working on trying to prevent these problems. People, you know, Elon Musk is putting his own money into things like universal basic income research, artificial intelligence research, but then at the same time having an insurance policy. Well, what happens if, the big earthquake hits on the West Coast? What happens if droughts get worse? What happens if natural disasters continue to get worse, which because of climate change, we expect them to? What happens if, Trumple Thin Skin says the wrong thing on Twitter and gets in a, you know, goes too far picking a fight with North Korea, and North Korea does decide to send a missile over. I've felt that way for a long time. I was one of the first kind of outed preppers in Silicon Valley. It turned out over the last few years, there's a lot more. It's just that people are pretty closeted about it. It's kind of a whisper thing, mostly because of the stigma.
There's a stigma.
Yeah, they were afraid to say, like, for example, I can't tell you how many of my friends in Silicon Valley would come to me and say, I want you to teach me how to shoot a gun. I'm afraid to say that to anyone else, because if I even admit the fact that I, like, if I admit that I believe anything other than all guns should be banned, I will be ostracized in the Silicon Valley echo chamber, which is true. That's a very real, Silicon Valley is there are only a few mental models that are accepted in Silicon Valley. So people would come and say, hey, teach me how to shoot, or take me into the woods and teach me how to build a shelter, or teach me how to do first aid. Teach me how to use ham radio. These things that people are interested in because they want to be more self-sufficient as people. They don't want to be victims. If the earthquake happens in San Francisco or LA, most of our peer group would be screwed, like fundamentally screwed. And more people are starting to realize that and say, what are the steps that I can take to just be a more self-sufficient, prepared human, not build a nuclear bunker and teach my toddlers how to shoot machine guns as part of a militia, but how can I have some basic supplies and skills so that if the earthquake happens, my children survive? And I've been teaching people that behind the scenes for years. And it got to the point in 2017 where it had gone mainstream enough where I felt like it was time to create a website for these people. So I started theprepared.com. It is a no propaganda, no politics, no crazy alt-right stuff. It's just good, rational guides and reviews that help people get prepared for a wide range of emergencies. Everyday things like car accidents, job loss, you see someone collapse from a stroke, up to things like natural disasters. Obviously, 2017 was a horrible year with all the hurricanes and wildfires. And then up to the big existential stuff, like what happens if the ecosystem collapses over the next 50 years? What happens if our government doesn't respond well enough to how our economy is changing with automation and driverless cars? What happens if we have 40% unemployment 30 years from now? And I just want to help people get prepared for that kind of stuff and let them know that it's okay to think about these things and you can do it rationally. And it's very, very, very different than the kind of Fox News doomsday bunker militia folks.
Were there things that you learned or saw working in government that have led you to starting this site?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Understand, I had always been, you know, you're kind of cliche Silicon Valley entrepreneur. You believe you can change the world. You can fix problems, right? I was always patriotic. When in school as a kid, when they say, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'd say president, right? I believed in that stuff. And then I had this wonderful opportunity to go be a part of some of the highest levels of our government, combined with the last few years where I've basically worked full time with various governments around the world, right? I've worked with socialist governments. I've worked with, in some cases, more kind of authoritarian governments all across the board. I've seen how that sausage is made around the world. And then had the honor of being able to do it, you know, with the White House and Pentagon in the US. And honestly, half of it was horrible. It was terrifying. Because my background, like my Silicon Valley background, is knowing how to solve problems and knowing how to build machines, build systems and ecosystems and cultures and processes and people that solve problems. I then, when I saw behind the curtain in government, I saw how fundamentally broken that problem-solving machine is. Like, we would think, like, we know education in America is broken. Just hands down, we know that. We know that governments or politicians have been talking about fixing education for decades. We know it hasn't happened. It's so predictable at this point that we just automatically dismiss anything a politician says because, no, we know that you're not going to, it's not going to work. You're not going to accomplish that. But we would like to think that there's a room full of really qualified people somewhere in government trying to fix education, right? Like we would think, we spend billions and billions and billions of dollars through the Department of Education and all this legislation and No Child Left Behind and all this kind of stuff. There's got to be a room full of the best people working on this problem, right? No, there isn't. It's horrible. I've been in that room and it's full of backstabbing morons who are only there because they're attracted to having a house of cards style job. It attracts the wrong people. The process is broken. The way legislation happens is broken. The way people are elected is broken. So at the very time when we need institutions like government to be working on these massively important problems, like will we have a planet to live on, that if there's a room full of people working on that problem, it's the wrong group of people and they're working on it in a fundamentally incorrect way.
And it is the wrong group of people because of the incentive structure in some form.
That's one of many, many issues.
The smartest people would not want to, I mean, do you still want to be president?
No, absolutely not. I don't want to, I will not run for office. I will not, frankly, do that again.
Not even like mayor, governor, or anything like that.
No.
Yeah. And what about, was there anything that you saw during your travels as well that caused you to learn something that made you want to create the Prepare?
Yeah. I'll give you a few examples. You and I and some other people at dinner the other night had a good conversation about how economic growth over the last couple decades, from an American point of view, came from, you know, outsourcing things to China, for example, right? We want cheap goods. So companies outsource to China to keep goods cheap and affordable, but they do that by sacrificing the environment, right? In order to have huge economic growth and pro-business growth, China destroyed its environment.
So yeah, essentially, outsourcing environmental destruction.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Like through globalization, we outsourced, low wage labor and environmental destruction to other countries and then patted ourselves on the back for protecting our watersheds in the States. So I travel around the world. I see how fundamentally we are just destroying it, right? Like we are destroying our planet for the sake of meeting Wall Street growth targets, right? And this is before Trump. On a more qualitative side of things, people ask me all the time, like, oh, wow, you know, you spent years traveling around the world. You lived in all these countries. You worked on these problems in all these different countries. What did you learn? Most of the time, they're expecting some kind of simple eat, pray, love kind of thing, right? One of the big things that I took away from it was understanding just how broken some things about America are. Now, just by being a well-read person in America without the traveling, you know, you hear about things like education in Scandinavia, right? Or other countries that have socialized medicine. You hear these things. But when you go and you live there and you truly see it, it's not about saying, oh, they're better than us. Their education system is better than us. It just reinforces for you that the way we do things in the US is certainly not the only way that they can be done. And in many ways are inferior. I love the Steve Jobs quote about everything in the world around us was made by people, right? And people that at the time knew far less about the world than we do now, right? We are living in a construct with rules and processes and symptoms that were designed by flawed people that understand a fraction of the world that you and I do today. We have to break those chains. We have to be willing to say, I'm not going to be on that path. I reject your reality and replace it with my own. I reject the notion that I have to be a wage slave until I'm 65 and then maybe have a nice retirement. I reject that notion. I reject the notion that I have to choose between doing fulfilling work and having kids. I reject the notion that, if I get sick, through no fault of my own. I just like sporadically developed cancer that it could crush my entire family for the rest of their life with financial debt. I reject those constructs. And by going to these other places around the world, it really just paints those contrasts that a lot of people in the US like to kind of, you know, put their fingers in their ears and close their eyes and chant about how great America is without truly understanding that it's not working. And a lot of the reasons why it's not working are identifiable. We can identify why things are broken, but the process to fix them is even more broken. And getting that contract, going around the world and doing this work, really kind of turned up the dial on the contrast, and it highlighted the parts in US. We've been talking about a lot about government, but even just culturally, even just consumerism, the way that people identify what a happy life is, right? Like people in Europe don't define themselves by their job title. People in the US do, right? So there's even cultural things like that, and you can start to see the patterns. And you can start to see how all these things are intertwined and they result in all the pains that we have today in America.
The Matrix.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of these things that I saw from spending time places like here in Colombia and then going back to the United States and feeling like I'm outside of the Matrix, like I'm seeing people's behavior being influenced by what's around them, and then slowly becoming one of them again. Yeah. over time, and then leaving and doing that a number of times. Like, I've got to get out of the Matrix.
Exactly. That's one of the biggest benefits. That's what I'm talking about with traveling. Like, your humans' brains adapts to fit their environment, right? So it's not that people are stupid. It's that it's our caveman lizard brain does its best to survive within the environment that it's in. So like, if you live in America, that becomes your reality. And you have to unplug yourself from that matrix to realize, holy hell, the rat race is dumb, or education can be better, or we could elect politicians that are smart and honest. It's possible. And people have become so plugged into the matrix in the US because we've got our own little bubble. We're geographically isolated, right? We've got oceans on both sides. We don't speak other languages. We don't travel as much as other countries. People in the US need to unplug themselves from the matrix, if for no other reason, just to have a better bird's eye view of how things are working in the US, how they could work differently, how they can make personal decisions about what kind of life they want to have, what kind of passion they want to pursue.
I think what would illustrate this matrix concept really well is your experience visiting North Korea, which I read your article on theprepared.com about North Korea. It's got tons of photos, lots of just absolutely shocking things. But the people who live in North Korea, they're living inside of a matrix as well.
Absolutely.
So what did you see there?
It's easy to talk about the North Koreans. I'll even give you a scarier example with my fellow travelers. So I was in a group of about 12 people. Okay. I was the only American, but a lot of like Germans and Swiss and things like that. I noticed that my traveling companions in this group, their brain started rewiring to adapt to the matrix in as little as 3 days.
How so?
I could see it in their behavior. Like on our third day in North Korea, people started in my group started saying to each other, "Oh, things aren't that bad here." Or, "Oh, no, it's fine." You know,
And were they bad?
Yeah. No, things are bad. But you normalize it, right? We've talked, you know, people have talked and thought a lot about normalization in the age of Trump. It's true. It's absolutely true. And, you know, I think 80% of North Korean citizens are fully bought into the matrix.
So one piece of the matrix, for example, you weren't allowed to use the bathroom.
Yeah.
At a place.
Yeah. So
because you're American.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's put it in context, right? Why has the North Korean regime survived when places like East Berlin, other dictatorships, why did those all fail while North Korea survived? They're not dumb. They looked at Gaddafi and Hussein and East Berlin, and they understood that part of the reason East Berlin fell was because of the osmosis of information. I have friends that grew up in East Berlin, and they could hear rap music over the wall, and that told them that the world was different outside the Matrix. North Korea survives by keeping a much tighter control on that, which is why it's called the Hermit Kingdom, because they have convinced the vast majority of their population that the outside world is worse off than North Korea. So they'll say to people, hey, you might think we have electricity problems. Americans are so poor and hungry, they're eating sewer rats.
And they will, when the electricity goes out in North Korea, they announce that the Americans stole our electricity again. Is that?
That's right. Yeah. So everything, part of their propaganda to their people is the Americans are evil imperialists. All of our problems are because of them. So they have notorious infrastructure problems. They have very little electricity. When you look at satellite imagery at night of the Asian continent, there's basically a black hole where North Korea is. When we were there, they of course wanted to show us that things were good. So they would take us to places that had electricity, but then there would still be frequent blackouts. And oftentimes when the power would cut out, I'd hear from one of the North Korean guards, oh, the Americans stole our electricity again. And then being the only American in the room, I would, you know, try to slink down in my chair and look German. But part of this propaganda is they tell their people how evil we are, which is why they need to listen to the Kims, because the Kims will protect them. We were on a long bus journey through the country. I think we were coming back from the DMZ, actually. And they pulled off in a little town to give us a bathroom break. And they pulled to a hotel. And it was a women's hotel, which is not unusual in Asia. Like in Asia, there will be subway cars that are only for women, right? So that's culturally somewhat normal. So it was a women's only hotel, fine. We pull up into the hotel, and the lead government handler, because we're controlled by government handlers the entire time, the lead handler stands up in front of the tour bus and says, this is for a restroom break. Everyone get off and use the restroom, except John, you have to stay on the bus. And they didn't tell me why. I found out later that I wasn't allowed to go into the hotel because as an American, I would rape the women in the hotel. So I wasn't allowed to go in and use the bathroom.
Okay. So, and I guess there was a lot of other stuff in this article where I guess I didn't realize how intense the Matrix was in a place like North Korea.
Yeah.
And so there's parallels that, I mean, there's not, there's a Matrix in the United States. It's not a North Korean Matrix, but
it's close.
There's a Matrix.
It's close. The Matrix in the US is, I think people underestimate how bad the Matrix is in the US.
Like for example, with North Korea, you were saying that you help somebody hear their first non-North Korean song.
Yeah.
And it was Happy by Pharrell Williams.
Right.
And somebody else whose favorite movie was Gladiator, and it was, he was able to watch it because there was a smuggled USB drive.
Right.
You were talking about public executions of families that were smuggling movies. Is that correct? Or
when I was in country, about 150 families were executed for having consumed foreign media.
Okay. So, for having consumed it.
Yeah. For watching.
So when this person heard this song Happy by Pharrell Williams, or when this other person saw Gladiator, they were risking their lives. Is that accurate? Or
to be precise, if the only thing that a North Korean had done was listen to the song Happy, they could be punished, but they wouldn't be executed because there's nothing in Happy that is subversive, right? If you were caught watching the movie Gladiator, yes, you and your family would either be sent to a re-education camp or you'd be executed, because the whole theme of that movie is overthrowing the emperor and, you know, those kinds of themes. So, for example, when I was searched coming in and out of the country, they wanted to make sure I didn't have Bibles, Qurans, any kind of literature that had any kind of revolutionary, and not like Marxist kind of revolutionary stuff or Mein Kampf kind of stuff, but even just an article like if let's say I had a magazine in my bag that had an article about Miranda rights in an arrest, that would have been considered blacklisted. So people that consume this foreign media, yeah, they all run a risk. The guy that listened to Happy, I don't think he'd be executed, but the guy that watched Gladiator, he would be. I did not give, I gave the song Happy to the guy. I did not give the Gladiator movie. I would not have done that. I actually had, I had the Hunger Games movies on my laptop before I went into the country, and I made sure to delete all of that kind of stuff.
So I, as I said, I looked at the prepared today, and like you said, it is no BS. It is very rational writing about these various products. And I assume the revenue then comes from affiliates.
Yeah.
So like on Amazon and stuff. And, you know, I saw meals ready to eat, MREs that you can, I don't know if you add water to them or what. I saw, like tanks that you can keep water in your house. What do you think are some of the most likely scenarios that a person might want to prepare for?
Well, it's mostly the common stuff, right? For example, I hear from a lot of people that have prepared who ended up benefiting from it due to sudden job loss, right? Think, you know, middle American family situation, maybe the husband and wife at the same time lose their job, and then they don't have the budget to eat. Right. Already, because things are not going well in America, right? The majority of Americans have less than $300 in savings. So when they suddenly lose their job, right, that's a disaster for them. You know, let alone a hurricane blowing down their house, but all of a sudden needing to support yourself when you only have $300 in savings, that's a disaster. That's an emergency. And people will then survive on, you know, the freeze-dried prepper food that they had in their basement. So it's even things like that. It's things like car accidents.
Okay, I thought you were going to be going to, oh, have more in your savings in case you lose your job. But in part it is, if you invest in that, having food available for a disaster, that it can actually help in these more common situations.
That too. Part of even what we're unique, the prepared is unique in this world of content, because we even talk about things like financial preparedness. Like, do you have at least 3 to 6 months worth of expenses in a liquid account? Do you have a safety net in your finances? Do you have a will? Do you have a do not resuscitate living will for medical instructions? The vast majority of Americans don't have even that. So we say, look, you know, pay yourself first, pay down your debt, build up a safety cushion, diversify your financial portfolio, even use kind of lazy tools like Wealthfront. Then start to think about things like, could I survive on my own in my house for 2 weeks if a hurricane comes and everything is screwed up for 10 days? And that food that then people stockpile in their basement is the same food that might help them get through a job loss situation, right? The good news is that most of the stuff that you do to prepare, it's very 80-20, and it applies to almost any situation, whether it's losing your job or a hurricane. So some of the fundamental steps for getting prepared, like anybody listening, you need to reject the notion that to be prepared means to have a nuclear bunker and a big Duck Dynasty beard and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, interesting. So that's not, I mean, do you see that as like kind of an edge case that's...
Yeah, those are people, there's the 80-20 to prepping. Those are the people that are in the 99th%. Like they've gone very extreme, right? They're fully off the grid. They've got an underground bunker. They've got an armory, right? Like that. That is way down the bell curve. The vast majority of people have a much more kind of equalized 80-20 approach to this.
Well, so let's say we have a lot of listeners in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. If you live in San Francisco, what do you think you should be preparing for? And what would be sort of the 80-20 of preparing for that?
Well, the first thing to do is to not kind of get tunnel vision on an earthquake or one particular type of emergency, right? Because nobody knows what's going to happen. We know that earthquakes are a risk, certainly in the West Coast, but it could be a car accident. It could be a house fire. It could be, for example, the wildfires that happened a few months ago in the Northern Bay Area. A lot of people in the city in San Francisco wanted to have respirator masks because of all the air pollution and the soot and the chemicals from the fires, making it hard for them to bike to work. Part of a good prep kit is a respirator. And I can't tell you how many people, how many of our friends on Facebook were like, oh, I'm not even going into work today because I can't ride my bike without a respirator mask. I went to the store to buy one and they're all sold out.
So how do respirator masks work?
Well, respirator masks like, they're basically just filters, right? It just creates kind of a pocket around your mouth.
So is that just like the kind of like a piece of paper that's over the mouth when somebody's sick or?
Well, that's actually,
I see people walking around with those in Medellin. Yeah. I don't know if it's because they're sick or because of the pollution
it's
here.
Probably the pollution it's probably the air pollution here. I'm actually writing an article about respirators right now for The Prepared because there's a lot of misinformation. People, when these wildfires were happening in the Bay Area, a lot of people went and bought kind of surgical masks, like the cheap paper masks that you just put over your mouth,
right,
that you see a lot of Asians wear. What they don't understand is that those masks are designed to prevent you from getting other people sick. They don't filter bad stuff in the air from getting into your lungs. So that's a perfect example of what we're doing at The Prepared.
And there are respirator masks that do help
exactly.
with that. And you're doing the research for that article.
Yeah, exactly. We're about to publish, you know, here's different types of respirator masks. Here's how they work. Here's the different ratings. Here are the products that we recommend. Here's a disposable one. Here's a full face gas mask. That's the kind of stuff that there's nothing irrational about somebody that lives in Los Angeles having a respirator mask somewhere in their home in case air pollution gets so bad or wildfire pollution gets so bad that they want to be able to bike to work or walk outside without feeling like they smoked a pack of cigarettes. That is an example of prepping. But historically, if you wanted to go find that information, you ended up on these websites and these YouTube channels run by these alt-right Duck Dynasty folks talking about gas masks, but interspersing it with about how Hillary was going to steal your children, you know, and how Obama's a Muslim, and they took her gerbs. I wanted to create something that was just straightforward, rational. Anybody could quickly do some Googling, say, what's the right thing I should buy? Click buy, done. That's it. You took a Saturday afternoon and you're now what I call Pareto prepared, the kind of 80-20 basics.
Okay, so a respirator mask.
So let's talk about the basics. So if you're living in Los Angeles, San Francisco, whatever, there's three basic steps to get Pareto prepared where you're able to handle 80% of any of the situations you might face.
With 20% of the equipment.
Exactly. 20% of the work.
Making that clear for the listeners that might not be familiar.
Yeah, exactly. So with just a little bit of work, a little bit of money, a little bit of time and effort, you can get to the point where you cover 80% of these scenarios, regardless of what the scenario might be. Car accident, wildfire, earthquake, whatever. Step one, be able to survive on your own in your house for 2 weeks. People use like the Red Cross and FEMA, they used to talk about 72 hours. So people might have heard of 72 hour kits. Very outdated information. 2 weeks is the minimum. We standardize around 2 weeks for this baseline. Because think about even like the recent hurricanes, right? Things weren't back to normal after 72 hours. Hell, as you and I talk right now, it's 4 months after, you know, the hurricane hit Puerto Rico. They still don't have power and drinkable water, right? So 2 weeks is the baseline. Can you survive on your own without the grid, without any outside help in your home for 2 weeks? The vast majority of Americans cannot. Most Americans have less than a day's worth of non-perishable food and water in their home that doesn't come out of the tap or come through the grid. So it's things like, do you have 2 weeks of potable water, right? Most people will think,
how much water is that?
Well, it's a gallon per person per day. So our baseline that we recommend to people is you need to have 15 gallons per person of potable water properly stored somewhere in your house. And that's easy to do. That can fit in the size of a couple shoeboxes, basically. People think, I'll just fill up the bathtub before the hurricane hits.
No, sorry, the water in those tanks, if you leave it sitting there for years, is it still potable?
That's a perfect example of things people don't know, right? Our ancestors used to know what water was safe to drink and what wasn't and how to purify it and where to get it. most people now don't, right? You turn on the tap and there it is, or you buy a $6 plastic bottle and it's got water in it. And we know that that falls away very quickly in emergencies. So that's an example of something we talked through on the prepared, is we did the research, we looked at the science and gave people the well-researched, kind of validated, you can trust this answer. Most water, or almost any water that comes out of a modern utility grid, is already chemically treated. So if you have a proper container and you put tap water in it, it'll be fine for 2 or 3 years at least, because it's already got some chemical preservatives in it, chlorine, things like that. If you put it in a container that is food grade plastic, it's dark, so it doesn't let light in, you store it properly, it'll last a long time. If you put tap water in a milk jug, that milk jug's going to deteriorate and there's bacteria in it that are going to grow. So if you do a couple just basic steps, you can fill something up with tap water, put it in your basement and change it every 3 years. And just that step has made you significantly more prepared than most people.
I mean, you can survive 3 weeks without food, right?
Yeah.
So 3 days without water.
Preppers talk about the rule of three. 3 minutes without oxygen, 3 hours without shelter in severe circumstances, like in a blizzard, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food.
Okay, so get 15 gallons of water per person in your home. If you're San Francisco, LA, New York, what are the other more important?
Think about that. That's actually what I really love about prepping, is it's kind of a mental, it's a stimulating mental challenge, right? Identifying your dependencies, thinking through just how dependent we've become on these things that are a lot more fallible and shaky than we think they are, like the water grid, right? Ask people in Flint, Michigan. Food, water, heat, communication.
The food is, there's all these like dehydrated food, like kits that you can get.
Yeah, I saw
on the site.
Yeah. There's a whole industry. Now, some people might be familiar with like Mountain House or kind of backpacking type of food, like camper food. So you can buy these pouches of freeze-dried food that you just add boiling water to, put them in your backpack when you're on a three-day hike, and that's what you eat. It's a similar concept for prepper food, right? A lot of the good stuff is freeze-dried. You can get these kits or these buckets, even Mountain House. Mountain House sells a 14-day, they call it a 14-day just-in-case case. And it's got about 14 days worth of 2,000 calories a day. And you just add boiling water to it and you're done.
It's just Soylent Green.
Well, you know, actually, when we did a test of all the different prepper food, we actually even looked at things like Soylent, the Silicon Valley company. Their shelf life wasn't good enough. You know, the shelf life of the freeze-dried food is 25 years or more. So you spend, two people can spend $150 for our recommended, the product that we picked. $150 covers two people for 2 weeks. You make that purchase one time, you put it in your closet, and if you need it anytime over the next 25 years, you're not running to the store to buy eggs and bread the day before the storm hits.
25 years.
Yeah, 25-year shelf life.
Wow. Yep. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I do recommend people go check out theprepared.com. It's really fascinating. I haven't thought about prepping, but I'm going to be thinking about it now. So... thanks so much for coming on the show. Where would you like for people to go to get more of either you or I guess theprepared.com?
Yeah, for anything prepping related, you know, theprepared.com. A lot of the other stuff we talked about, my traveling work, the government work, that Nomadic Mentors, Silicon Valley, you know, my Twitter, JPRAMEY.
Great. John Ramey, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me, man.
Is Love Your Work helping inspire you to pursue the life and work that you love? If so, I could really use your help. This show takes work and it takes money to make. To keep making the show and to keep it free for everyone, it needs your support. Besides subscribing and reviewing the show, there's one big thing you can do to help, and that is to donate. I work to make this show nourishing and thoughtful. In an economy that's all about grabbing attention, this is not the short route to success. If you believe in Love Your Work's message of living a balanced life and finding fulfilling work, please join Love Your Work Elite, hosted on Patreon. Patreon is a platform that lets you support creators like me, vote with your dollars, and keep Love Your Work going. You're going to get bonus content and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at lywelite.com. That's lywelite.com. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by top Love Your Work Elite members, such as Arif Akhtar. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for the show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.